exactly the way you feel in the famous Dodge Enterprise.
Welcome to Weldcast, a digital project from the High Plains Library District. This project records, documents, and preserves the rich artistic history of Weld County and its residents through storytelling. The stories are stored digitally and are available to all users online at weldcast.com. My first cinematic experience was Star Wars. To say that I was entranced, enraptured, as a five-year-old ESL kid fresh off the adoption boat from South Korea would be an understatement. Star Wars blew my mind. It was one of those catalytic experiences that rewires one's brain. That film helped to lay the groundwork at a very young age for the way I learned to perceive and cognize the strange and beautiful world that we live in. As with great literature, great cinema has that power. And I've loved the movies ever since. In this episode of Weldcast, I have the pleasure of talking about the movies, specifically the Western, with Chris Gamer and Victoria Boone, co-founders of the Go West Film Festival, the first Western genre film festival in Colorado.
I'm Victoria Boone. I live in Greeley, Colorado. I work for the High Plains Library District as their collection development librarian and been with the district going on 12 years.
And I'm Chris Gamer. I'm also a librarian with the High Plains Library District. I have been with High Plains for a little over 9 years now.
Great. So you guys are here because you both started a film festival in Greeley, Colorado, and you guys have called it Go West, the Go West Film Festival. You want to give us a little background on that, how it started? Why you thought it would be a good idea to do it in Greeley?
Sure. I'll start because I actually am one of those weirdos that makes a bucket list. So on my bucket list for the last 20 years has been to start a film festival. Because I've volunteered at film festivals, I've attended film festivals, and I'm like, I want to do this myself someday. But then Chris entered the picture, and we ended up being co-workers at the Centennial Park Library. Turns out she also has a love for film. And I think just the conversations that you and I had, Chris, as well as a film discussion group that I led with you, Jamie, helped me to see that Greeley does love film, and it could be it could really work here. So I edited my bucket list and made it start a film festival in Greeley. And Chris and I just sort of started brainstorming from there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, we both have a love, a passion for film. And just kept talking about it. At that time, it was more of a kind of a wishful thinking dream.
Pie in
the sky. Like, could we make this work? And wouldn't it be really cool to do that? And I know for myself, years ago when I was in library school, I listened to a lecture by Patty Wong. She's a mover and shaker in the library world. And I was really, I took to heart something she said about libraries and librarians being catalysts for a change or, events or programs within the community rather than being, you know, kind of a tag-along partner in community endeavors. She said, yeah, librarians and libraries should be catalysts for something that's really revolutionary in your community. And being a new library student at the time, I really took that to heart. And I think that's kind of what influenced me in thinking, hey, something like this could really, really work. And it would be so cool to have librarians and a library district be kind of a catalyst for a community film festival like this.
Yeah, and being librarians, we did what every good librarian would do, and we researched film festivals. When we started really, like, okay, let's make this happen, we started researching how many film festivals are happening in Colorado, and there are a lot, but none of them are Western-focused. So Chris actually had the genius idea to make it a niche and to really focus and narrow it down, considering where we're located. We're in the High Plains of Colorado.
Right.
So I thought that was genius.
Do you guys both love Westerns?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. I know for me, it's a sentimental attachment. Mm-hmm. I was very, very close to my maternal grandparents, and my grandfather was an audiovisual departmental head for a school district, and he cared for all the, you know, the film, you know, film reels back then, and he'd bring things home. So I have a lot of fond memories of, you know, sitting down in the living room and getting to stay up past my bedtime and you know, watch movies with my grandfather and eat black licorice, which it totally astounds me that a four-year-old kid or five-year-old kid would like black licorice. But I think it was just the whole kind of fun experience of staying up late and watching movies with my grandfather. I would kind of question now as a parent and a grandparent myself some of the things I saw at 4 years old, like The House of Wax with Vincent Price. But he was very, very fond of Westerns, so I watched a lot of Westerns with him and have a lot of very fond memories of that. The one thing I love about Westerns is that if you watch enough Westerns and you really explore, you know, the Western genre, they really defy a lot of conventional stereotypes. At the same time, they kind of, you know, foster those stereotypes, they also break those stereotypes. And that's one of the appeals of Western film to me. Because that's the one thing that we were questioned about, like Westerns, you know. People are thinking, you know, like High Noon and Who Shot Liberty Valance. But again, if you're a fan of Western film, there's a huge number of subgenres in Western film, and it's kind of this self-reflexiveness about you know, the genre that's really fun. You right. know, you have, you know, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly trilogy paying, or The Magnificent Seven paying homage to, right. you know, Kurosawa, and then right. and then kind of coming back again too. So it's really fascinating to right. see what people do with the notion of the Western and how they kind of follow the classic tropes, but then also kind mm-hmm. of play around and transmute some of those notions.
Let's right. talk about The Magnificent Seven. So that's sort of an interesting kind of arc of how it got created. So there's this Japanese director who grew up watching and loving American Westerns. So he makes his own version with Seven Samurai, and, you know, it's this, you know, so it's, they're going to protect this town from the bad guys, and the peasants go and ask for help, and there's this misfit band of samurai, right? And mm-hmm. it's a great movie. And then I don't know who directed the American version, but, you know, and then you have all these American directors who watch that movie and were blown away, and it gets redone back as a Western.
Right.
You get Yul Brynner, and I forgot who else was in it, and you get this awesome Western. Mm-hmm. And then, so this goes back to the genre Western. And then later on, I'm watching this movie with my kids called Bug's Life, and I'm like, wait a second. This is Magnificent Seven. Yeah, this yeah. is mm-hmm. Seven Samurai.
Completely.
So would you consider Bug's Life a Western?
Pregnant pause.
I wouldn't classify that as a Western.
So why?
But you could say that it's paying homage to
right.
some of those tropes of the Western. Again, right. what you're looking at is kind of the underdog. You know, this ragtag group of
right.
Outlaws, essentially, mm-hmm. In the Magnificent Seven, or the samurai.
Right.
So what
makes those two? The Magnificent Seven for sure is a Western, classically. Mm-hmm. Seven Samurai, you can argue, is a Western. It's just set in a different country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Bug's Life, it's modernized, it's animation. But why is that not a Western? I mean, it's exactly the same story, same arc, same conflicts. Everything's the same, except for their bugs.
Their bugs.
And it's animated. So what makes it not a Western? Is it the costume, the period piece kind of vibe is gone? So I'm just trying to figure out what's mm-hmm. a Western, what... And why wouldn't that be a Western?
Well, if you just look at practically from the film industry point of view, like mm-hmm. if they're pitching this to the theaters or trying to make a poster of it, they could turn that very well into an advertising piece for a Western if they just, you know, like I'm thinking of Rango which was very obviously an animated film,
right.
you know, not your typical John Wayne Western,
right.
but they very obviously made that setting in the West.
Right.
You know, you have the cowboy.
Right.
Gecko.
So that
just
would
a
be
great
a
film.
Western animation.
Right. And Bug's Life, they could have swung that way,
right.
but I'm imagining, so one answer is from the marketing film industry point of view, they clearly did not want to make that an overt Western.
Right.
However, if we show that at Go West, we could very easily pull in, this is the Western tropes that are
right.
obvious in A Bug's Life. So
right.
we could technically show something like that, or like The Last Picture Show, which probably was never marketed as a Western.
Right.
There's things that you you can, I look at it as flattery because I'm always looking at everything with my Western lens. And so to me, it's like, I'm flattered that Bug's Life took Magnificent Seven. And I would love an opportunity to point that out to people because right. when you say that, actually, I think it was you who pointed it out to me, Jamie. I just thought that's fantastic Bug's Life was Magnificent Seven. And Rob actually on our committee said the same thing.
Oh, did he? Yeah. I should watch it again. It's been years. I think
it's going back to its roots at its heart. You have this wild, untamed land, good versus evil. And that can, you know, the wild, untamed land could be outer space. That's why it works so well with science fiction. It could be the middle of Japan. It could be a bug's life. So I think that's fascinating to see that this very core, simple formula almost, or tropes, can just be shown in a bunch of different ways. And to me, I'm just like, hip, hip, hooray. I mean, let's do a musical. Let's do a, I mean, whatever. However you want to expand on that, I think it's just a compliment to the ultimate roots of it, which is very American. There's not very many Western, I mean, there's not very many film creative art things that American just say is ours. You know, jazz may be one.
Right.
And Westerns.
And it's been exported to,
yes.
and everyone's kind of modified it for their...
And I say modify away because it works.
Right.
And I think one thing you had mentioned early on, landscape is integral to the Western. I mean, in many ways, the landscape is becomes a mirror for you know, the soul of the character.
Right.
And if that character is undergoing a particular transformation, it's usually mirrored in you know, kind of the landscape. We screened The Revenant this year, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, the scope and the beauty and the harshness of the landscape, you know, basically is being expressed through through the character. So I think, you know, again, what constitutes or makes a Western, that's a very important part of it.
I don't know if you've seen a movie called Matewan. It's about union busting.
Oh, absolutely.
In
the,
maybe in the Appalachians.
I love that movie.
And that's really kind of a Western, but kind of modern, you know, like, and I thought that was, and watching that even like as a high schooler, it was really impactful. And not that much graphic violence. I think there's only one scene where someone gets shot, but it was so intense and so beautifully done. It's still kind of, it's kind of left a mark on me.
It's funny you mention that because I think some of the diehard Western groupies wouldn't consider that a Western, but that's what we love about our film festival is we try to broaden that scope, and Matewan's definitely on my top 10, and I wouldn't have even thought of making that a Western, but you're right. It's got the defending the town and the good guys, bad guys, and the shootout at the end. And
Had a similar conversation when we were sharing with audience members why we're showing The Last Picture Show, one of the most perfect films ever. But again, I love the whole opportunity to kind of open people's minds a little bit about what a Western is.
Right.
And, you know, if it's a neo-Western in the case of The Last Picture Show, you know, kind of expanding that definition of the Western, and it becomes a conversation, which is really not only my love of film, but the desire to share that love with people and really talk about film. That's kind of the beauty of this film festival, is being able to do that. And yeah, people who saw that said, this is really a great film. And now I get it. I understand why you're showing this film.
Right. So let's go back to Westerns as a genre. Why wouldn't have you gone with like sci-fi? It's mostly because we're in the West now, right? Because it's Colorado and kind of fit better. And...
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Right.
When Victoria and I were doing our initial research, and really I credit Victoria for kind of delving into that aspect before we kind of got off the ground. It's like, well, no-brainer. We're here in the West. Why aren't there, you know, why isn't there a Western film festival?
And I'm surprised there isn't a Western film festival anywhere. So you guys did the research, and we're pretty much the first.
In Colorado.
Okay. Yeah. And I think one of the things we thought, or that was kind of like near and dear to my heart, was that I wanted to take, you know, this appreciation and love of classic and contemporary Western film, but also provide an opportunity to showcase documentary films that showcase issues currently impacting the West. Water rights, land, you know, fracking, if you will. So kind of couching or, you know, placing those films in a film festival would, you know, inspire people to maybe watch a documentary they wouldn't have watched otherwise outside of the film festival, and use as an opportunity to educate the public on these issues that are impacting us and will continue to impact us. So that was kind of a particular passion piece in this project for me, was to include those.
Right.
And interestingly, those have been some of our highest attended films, these unknown documentaries. You would, I mean, of course, John Wayne has been very popular, but our unknown documentaries. So
like
we had
our
first year, we had a Denver filmmaker, Ethan Nightchild, show a film about ghost towns from Colorado and the Southwest in general.
Right.
People loved that. It was our highest attended at that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year we showed Hannah's Ranch, which was Mitch Dickman, also a Denver filmmaker, which was about ranching and the issues that deal with ranching and the depression that this one local rancher went through that eventually led to his death. And again, very well embraced. People didn't know anything about it before this. And then this year was really interesting because we showed Unbranded, a film about wild Mustangs and some young guys who take wild Mustangs from Mexico all the way up to the Canadian border just to show the power and the majesty of Mustangs, and made this beautiful film, just some of the most beautiful cinematography I've ever seen.
Right.
I'll never look at horses the same way again. It was just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And but just also introduced some of the statistics about how wild Mustangs are, the issues that are around that
right
now. So that made for a great discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris put together a great panel of guests to discuss, like the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, came and actually talked about some of the issues that are going on with that.
So can I ask, can we go back to square one? Define what a Western is. Because, you know, it's a gigantic genre. I mean, Firefly can be a Western, and
there is actually a Western with that cast in there. What is it called? I know we talked about it, about having it this festival early on.
Serenity, are you talking
Serenity,
about?
Serenity, yeah.
Which
Serenity,
is part of Firefly.
Right.
Oh, that is. That's an F. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Same.
Mm-hmm.
Same.
So define what a Western... I mean, most people, when you say Western, won't think of a documentary, really. Really what they're thinking is John Wayne and maybe Clint Eastwood and a couple of other things. And those are the traditional Westerns.
More to do with time period. What's the time period that a Western is supposed to address, like that
I don't know if I want to put myself out there during a podcast, but
it
basically
has
a
time period.
It has a distinct time period, but mostly it kind of addresses kind of a certain code of honor of an individual who is, basically pitted against the landscape, the domination of an environment, the landscape, and he's kind of a loner.
Right.
But has a certain code of ethics. And
the civilizing of the West.
The taming, the civilizing of the West, and how.
So is it geographically specific? I mean, it doesn't have to be in the American West. Can it be in Mongolia? I mean,
absolutely. Well, in our mind, it doesn't have to be.
Right. So this is what I'm asking. So how narrow is that term? I mean, if you think of Western, it could be in space. It could be in the American West. It could be in outer Mongolia, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
So is it more of an idea? Like the Western is, like you were saying, it's more a taming of oneself and one's landscape and sort of the slow civilizing of a culture or community and everything kind of the messiness around that.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of a good old-fashioned story of the good guys versus the bad guys. And again, you know, how you have this personal code of honor and how that plays out in this particular social milieu, if you will. So you talk about, does it have to be restricted to the American West? Absolutely not. There are transnational Westerns. The Australians are particularly brilliant at filming these. There are other many transnational Westerns. We last year we showed Slow West, which was kind of a transnational in the sense that it was really a multi national cast, if my memory serves me correctly.
And filmed in New Zealand.
And then we actually had considered showing an Australian Western called The Proposition, which is a really, really solid film.
Hmm.
And again, takes a lot of those Western tropes of, these bad guys are kind of holed out, and, the lines of their badness and goodness is kind of, blurring a little bit. And that's another kind of feature of a lot of Western films, especially like, you know, you think about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right.
You know, like is Clint Eastwood's character doing this out of self-preservation, you know, or, you know, you see glimmers of like doing the right thing. So right. there's a lot of internal struggle with characters and right. their code of, you know, their code of honor. But that's what's fun about the genre, because it really plays with those tropes. It's not like the classic Western necessarily of all the good guys. Tom Mix wore a white hat and the bad guys wore black hats, and you clearly knew who the good guy and the bad guys were. What's fun about the whole Western film experience now is that you really have sometimes those playing around again with those tropes and stretching the idea right. of a classic Western into different areas.
Yeah, so, actually, I think a good example of that I just discovered this year was Unforgiven, which is, mm-hmm. you know, an award-winning Western
right.
with Clint Eastwood. Turns out that there's a Japanese version of the exact same story called Unforgiven, except mm-hmm. in Japanese, starring Ken Watanabe.
Mm-hmm.
But yet it's set in Japan and in the outlying area. I'm still waiting for the DVD to come in so I can even watch it. But it's not trying to pretend it's in America. I mean, it is set right. in Japan in that time period, but the entire story recreated except in a Japanese setting
right.
with Japanese, which just mm-hmm. is fascinating to me, and the ultimate compliment.
So is it set more in modern times, or is it set
kind of... No, it's
kind
set
of,
in
so
the
So would you
1800s.
Consider that a Western?
Yeah, I'm okay. very excited yeah. okay. to see it
we
and
actually,
potentially show it.
Yeah, we actually put the trailer up on our Facebook mm-hmm. page when the huh. trailer came out. It's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of this... kind of the self-reflexiveness about you know, the genre. That's really fun. You
right.
know, you have, you know... The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly trilogy paying, or the Magnificent Seven paying homage to,
right.
you know, Kurosawa, and then
right.
and then kind of coming back again too. So it's really fascinating
right.
to see what people do with the notion of the Western and how they kind of follow the classic tropes, but then also kind mm-hmm. of play around and transmute some of those notions.
What's your favorite Western, would you say, in your top three, Victoria?
Oh, that's a tough question, Jamie.
Yeah.
However, because I always talk to people about films, they're always asking my favorite films, and in my top list are a few Westerns. So one is High Noon.
Mm-hmm.
Just
original High Noon.
The original High Noon mm-hmm. with Gary Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And also Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Of course.
And... the original Magnificent Seven. Those
right.
are probably my top ones, which we've already shown at the
mm-hmm.
film festivals,
right.
all three of
mm-hmm.
those. So.
And how about you, Chris? What are your, if you had to name your top three today?
Today. I would say one of my top is The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. It's
the
a
Brad
great...
Pitt movie, or the
yes,
one? Was
yes,
there, the... is there another
mm-hmm.
one? Okay,
yeah, with Brad Pitt and okay. Casey Affleck. I just happened to listen to an interview with Terry Gross
mm-hmm.
with Casey Affleck for Manchester
mm-hmm.
by the Sea, and just hearing that yesterday driving home from work, it kind of triggered that. Like, yes, I love that film. I loved, mm-hmm. absolutely loved the poetic,
right.
You know, pacing of that film, really getting into the character.
Right.
I'd say that's probably among my top. Oh my gosh, you're putting me on the spot here. Holy cow, there is just so many. Oh, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which we did screen this year. I had been kind of championing that film, you know, since we started the film festival. And this year, the committee was on board to show it. And it really resonated with a lot of folks. We actually got that back on our surveys that they really liked.
Yeah. We had a great discussion.
Yeah, they had a good, good discussion of
right.
that film. Let me see. My third one. I got to tell you, I'm a sucker for the Sergio Leone trilogy,
absolutely.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So I really kind of pushed that we complete the trilogy this year
right.
And host the spaghetti luncheon. And again, it's a sentimental attachment,
right.
Which mm-hmm. I think largely a lot of film is. You really have these attachments to certain films because, you know, you've seen them at certain points in your life and you kind of remember, you know, where you're at in time. For me, it's a very fond memory of actually seeing that movie at the drive-in theater and probably somewhere in Aurora or outside
wow.
of Denver when I was a kid. Again, my parents took me probably when they should not have, right. But they'd always tell me at what point I should cover my eyes. so I'd be in the back seat of our T-Bird, and they'd say, "Cover your eyes, Chrissy," and I would go ahead and cover my eyes. And then peak,
right.
Of course. Absolutely fell in love with the soundtrack. My mother had that soundtrack and played it a lot.
Right.
And I remember we actually had a poster of Clint Eastwood from the movie. It's a movie poster in our apartment. So very sentimental attachment to that movie, I think. And but again, all the films we've shown, I've loved or fallen in love again with. True Grit was. The 2010 version of True Grit,
right.
I kind of fell in love with all over again. Right. And really
was that the Coen brothers that did
yes,
that?
Yes,
that was
yeah,
a great movie.
Yeah, the Coen brothers. And it was really interesting because our discussion leader, Stacy, kind of prefaced that saying, you know, it's a little bit different, but really it's one of their more conventional films.
Absolutely. I thought the same thing.
And it's beautiful.
Very
it really,
by the book Western.
By the book, but yeah. It was with love
yeah.
that they filmed it. It was clearly a love of Westerns. And
right.
It was impeccable. Their filming and their rendering of it.
Right.
So, but I after seeing that on Friday, was it Friday? Yeah, Veterans mm-hmm. Day. I was like, this is a damn good film. I really like it. They did such a good job with it.
It's funny that you mention all the sentimental connections because mm-hmm. Because this conversation comes up a lot at the film festival. So why Westerns? What's your favorite? Mm-hmm. Where did you, especially some of our elderly attendees, they're surprised that someone, quote, younger, which I love being considered younger, has this affinity for Westerns. And so I have been racking my brain, like, where did all this start? Like, where did my love affair with Westerns begin? And I can trace it back to my dad mm-hmm. and my big brother because I wanted to spend time with them. I'm the baby of the family, and I'm like, I gotta have something in common with, you know, these men that it seems when you're young and an insecure young girl, you don't know if you have anything in common with them. So I would sit while they would watch their TV Westerns and Clint Eastwood. My brother started me on this tradition that every Christmas Eve we would watch a Clint Eastwood Western. So while the rest of America is watching It's a Wonderful Life, we're watching Hang 'em High, you know, and
right.
to me that's so
that's
normal.
Funny.
Like, I can't even imagine watching a Christmas movie on Christmas Eve. It's got to be a Western by Clint Eastwood.
Looking back on it, what would you have changed or done differently this year, first year, second year, and how has it evolved in the last 3 years?
Good question.
Yeah. I think one direction we're going into is submissions. You know, we're a committee of 12 and largely volunteer, all volunteer essentially, and great group of people, but you can only do so much, you know, with a day job. So that's going to be our next goal is to, you know, encourage submissions from Colorado filmmakers or filmmakers outside of the state. We kind of got our toes wet with that this year by us screening a short by Rob Walker. He's here in the Greeley community. He's actually on our committee. Very, very amazing creative here in Greeley. So it was well received, a very solid short. So now we're ready to kind of branch off into submissions. But I think we're doing pretty well so far in terms of our community partners. The CRESS has been a tremendous partner in this. They've been wonderful and really have embraced this project, and as has UNC, International Film Series, Ames, really good core group of partners that are on board with this. So, yeah.
Victoria, do you have anything to add to that?
I would say, and I know what I like when I go to film festivals, is that unique insight from people who are actually doing it. So to host more filmmakers mm-hmm. local, we have showed El Mariachi this year, which is Robert Rodriguez, who's now like a famous director.
Wasn't that his first feature?
It was his first feature.
Right.
Out of
film school.
On a shoestring budget.
$7,000.
Yeah.
Right. So it was very important to, and a lot of people were like, why are we showing this? And, it, you know, it's all his friends, not even professional actors who are in it. It's wonderful. I mean, it is like the definition of independent film.
Right.
And was like the film festival darling the year that it came out. And people were a little confused why we were showing it, but they trust us. They just show up not knowing anything about this film, and they learn about its significance in the independent film, in the whole independent independent industry. And then what was particularly exciting to me was one of the Ames film students afterwards came up to me and is very excited to submit a film next year. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, awesome. Yes, here's the contact information. Please, please, please. We want to show your film at this film festival.
Yeah.
There seems like there's so much potential. I mean, just you mentioning this Ames student being excited about, I mean, you could do little contests for shorts, you know, like, and give away some kind of prize or something. Guys, tell me a little bit about the structure and format of the film festival. You know, I know how most film film festivals are structured, but is yours different in any way, or do you kind of do it by the book?
Well, again, we put on our librarian hats and we kind of researched how other libraries do, I mean, how other film festivals do it. And so I think we're kind of a mix of everything we liked from a variety of film festivals. Chris and I are huge fans of Telluride Film Festival. So one of the things we really, really love about that are the discussions and the information that they provide for us. So our films are roughly a week long, couple films a day. This is in general. There are sometimes exceptions if there's something going on. Like this year, we didn't do anything for election night. But technically, it's a week, two shows a week, a day. And every film has an introduction by somebody who has kind of researched the details of the film, the filmmaker, actors, its significance, and then hosts a discussion afterwards.
So are we talking roughly about 14 films in a week?
12.
Yeah.
Well, so maybe it's 6 days.
Yeah, what we do is we, like Victoria said, it's kind of a conventional format. We have a kickoff screening on Sunday night at the Cress, and that will be just our first screening, and then generally two films a day, and then we'll have a wrap up on Saturday, which we did. We have started showing an afternoon film on Saturday, and then we'll have a wrap up event.
All the venues, I'm assuming, are going to be within the Greeley city limits?
Yes, yes.
And so who are some of your partners, and where are these screening locations? And how did that come about?
Yeah, well, we basically, first, after we formed a very small core committee in our first year, Victoria and I went to the Cress. The Cress has always been a very supportive partner with a lot of Greeley events, and they were very open to the idea. And so we went to the Cress at, you know, first, and then we've had, you know, partnership with the International Film Series at UNC, so we went to them and they were on board with it. Ames Community College, Greg Driscoll is an instructor there that Victoria had met a number of years ago. She actually attended a Westerns 101 free lecture one year.
It makes me think of that quote from Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, as soon as we started talking about this, we started realizing all these people we already had that are like, they have a similar interest, they have a similar passion, or they have the knowledge, and it's just, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. Greg popped out, Ron and David, you know, from the IFS stage.
Ron and Thelma Edgerton, David Caldwell.
Right.
So we just kind of started to kind of reach out to different people, and like Victoria said, if you kind of build it, they'll come, and then word of mouth gets out, and then people kind of came to us, you know, somewhat. Like, yes, we'd like to be a part of this and like to help support you in this endeavor.
We were talking earlier off tape about you put out a survey about what people loved most about, and one of the responses, or one of the most positive feedback you got was the discussion after the film. And a lot of film festivals have a panel where people discuss the film, but not, I don't know of any really that everyone who has watched the film becomes an active participant in the discussion for every film shown.
True.
So can you talk a little bit about that and how it's integrated into the film festival and what makes that special?
Well, I think the germ for that, at least for me in my mind, was the film discussion group that Jamie, you and I hosted here at the Farr Library. That was for about 4 or 5 years, quite a while ago. That was the germ that helped me to see people will stick around and talk about a movie afterwards, because I just didn't know.
I know
I like to do that,
but
I thought me and one other person will stick around and talk about this movie.
Well, I think we thought, who's going to stick around 11 at night to talk about a movie? And it turned out a lot of people.
Right. We have to kick them out of the library and say, okay, we need to go home now, which is the power of film. I think it's just one of those artistic expressions that gets people, I think it makes them feel comfortable and it makes them feel like they have some safe ground to discuss wide variety of points of view. So I think for me, at least, that was my germ. I don't know about, you know, if Chris had had a similar discussion group actually about film at the library.
I had a based on the book film group for about 3 years. And that was the particular niche there as well, that people are really wanting that sense of community. They want, and again, in our surveys, that was kind of uniformly the feedback we received, is that they're really seeking that sense of community, being able to, you know, discuss, you know, a film or, you know.
At least half, or I'd say around half, of the attendees always stick around for a discussion afterwards about the film. So that helps us to, in a tricky way, do what we call film literacy as us librarians. Mm-hmm. We're really teaching them how to view a movie, but also consider, you know, the history of when it was released and what, you know, all the influences that go into film literacy. So that part, I thought we might have to sell and try to really work hard to create. People like that community involvement. So I think that's what's made it so successful, especially our community partners that Chris just listed. So just coming from the librarian point of view, I used to, for like 12 years, I hosted a book club, which is, you know, everybody knows and associates that with libraries and books, and that nobody thinks twice about that. The beauty of all reading the same book and then talking about it, differing opinions, liked it, didn't like it, you know, what stood out to you. So why not extrapolate that to film?
Absolutely.
Same concept. So, but yeah, I don't see that at other film festivals. Yes, the introduction to the film and perhaps some discussion from the filmmaker himself, the director or actor, talking about the experience of the film.
And maybe a short Q&A after.
But not so much about how did it make you feel?
Right.
What does this movie mean to you?
Exactly.
Did it change your world perspective? Or I think that is one of our unique things that I'm most proud of.
For more information about the Go West Film Festival or to contact Chris and Victoria, please visit Go West Film Festival on Facebook or www.gowestfilmfest.org. Thank you for listening to this episode of Weldcast. If you'd like more information about the project or you would like to participate, please visit our site at www.weldcast.com or by calling 1-888-861-7323. This has been a production of the High Plains Library District.